Welcome in Entreprendre dans la mode, the podcast for fashion actors and entrepreneurs. I am Adrien Garcia, I am designer, and every week I am interviewing leading figures of the fashion industry to understand their pathway, their questions, and their strategies to innovate and to develop their business. The podcast is available on every platform. Subscribe to it to not miss any episode. Please enjoy the conversation. Hello everybody. Thank you for listening Entreprendre dans la mode. Today we are welcoming Jeff Abrams. He is the founder of Frails. Hello Jeff.
Hello.
So to begin with, I would like you to present yourself and to come back on your pathway from the very beginning where you were born, or did it start everything?
Yeah, it's a long story, but I'll try to give you a good recap.
Yeah.
So yeah, my name is Jeff Abrams. I'm the founder and creative director of Rails. I feel like I do a little bit of everything, so sometimes it's hard to say exactly what my role is, but as you can imagine, starting a business, you have to do a little bit of everything. But I started the line about 10 years ago, more than 10 years ago, very small, and I had no technical background in fashion when I started. So I'm from Los Angeles, and I wanted to make a line that was Southern California lifestyle, like very casual, relaxed. But more internationally influenced, something that felt more elevated. And I had actually been living in Italy after I graduated from university.
What did you study?
So, well, I had studied political science. Okay. So I thought, oh, maybe I'm going to become a lawyer. I'm going to do something professional. But I had always grown up doing art. And whether it was photography or sculpture or painting, I really had a creative drive. Okay. And I knew that going down a professional route, becoming a lawyer, that wasn't the route I wanted to take.
Who were your heroes when you were a child?
Well, to be honest, I probably was more into sport when I was younger, and I was, you know, I played every sport when I was younger, whether it was basketball or what we call soccer, which you call football.
Yes.
Baseball. So, but I was, you know, doing a lot of sport, but I was in my spare time, I was doing photography, and I had a dark room in my house.
Wow.
When I was growing up. So this is when people were using film cameras, not digital cameras. So I had an old camera, which my uncle had given me, and I was going around taking photos, and then I was taking the film into the dark room in the house.
So nice.
And developing them and just trying to find whatever creative outlet I could. But I grew up in a family of women also. So I have two sisters and my mom, all of them were also into creative fields and they were very into fashion. So I sort of grew up in that space, but nobody actually had a fashion background in my family. Mm. So anyway, fast forward to, I went through university and now trying to figure out what am I going to do. And I had studied for one semester in Europe, in Italy. And then when I graduated from the University of California, Berkeley, I said, I need to go back to Europe and really spend more time and maybe immerse myself in art and culture and sort of see what's happening. So I was living in Europe. I was traveling around on the Eurorail, going to all these different countries. And so this cool. is how I got the name Rails was, you know, I visited France and I was in Spain and all over Italy and I went up to Scandinavia and I was saying, wow, all these things I want to blend with my Southern California lifestyle. Find a way to fuse the elevated, you know, European aesthetic with the Southern California casual lifestyle. So I didn't really know how to get started in apparel. So I knew I wanted to try that route though. So I bought a black hat, a hat from a company that was already made. It wasn't like a baseball hat, but it was similar. And I put a logo on it that said Rails. And then I started walking around to stores with my one hat.
Just back in California, right?
In California, yeah. This was in Los Angeles. So I had one black hat and I walked into a store and I said, hey, do you want to buy this hat? And everybody was telling me, you only have one hat. You need to have a clothing
collection,
line.
Yeah,
a collection. So everybody was telling me no. And I had one friend who was working at a boutique called Fred Siegel in Los Angeles, which was
super famous.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. So
there's a friend of you.
Yeah, and a friend, she was working just in the store.
Okay.
And I said, can you put it on the counter on consignment? Meaning, I'll leave it on the counter. If you sell it, you can pay me. If not, I'll take the hats.
Just one hat.
Yeah, and I gave them, you know, three or four hats. So at least it looked like a nice display.
Yeah.
So she said, okay. So I put the hats and then people started buying the hats. Mm. And she called me and said, we need more hats. I said, okay. So I you know, bought six more hats. I put the logo on it. I gave them six more hats. And then I thought, okay, who do I know in Los Angeles that knows some celebrity? Maybe I can get a celebrity picture of somebody wearing my hat. So I knew somebody who knew the boyfriend of Jessica Alba. And I said, can you give this to that person to give to Jessica Alba? Maybe she'll like it.
Yeah.
So maybe 2 weeks later, I saw there was a picture of Jessica Alba wearing the hat.
Wow.
So I said, wow, okay, let me print the picture. So then I went into another store and I said, I'm selling in Fred Siegel and I have a picture of Jessica Alba wearing my hat. And so little by little, I started, you know, trying to get people to pay attention to what I was doing. Yeah. So first I was doing the hats. Then Fred Siegel told me, are you going to expand the collection? So I made one hooded sweatshirt, a zip-up hoodie. Mm-hmm. So, and I went to Garment Diet in three colors, black, blue, green. And when I washed the fabric, all of it came twisted. So the zipper started at the top center. And then as you went lower on the garment, it went off to the side. So yeah. It was like a twisted zipper. And I thought, oh, this is a disaster. Yeah. I'm out of business. And then it turned out everybody thought it was amazing. It was the coolest hoodie they'd ever seen. And so they started selling the hoodies at Fred Siegel. And then Matthew McConaughey, who's, you know, a famous actor at the time, came into the store and said, wow, I love this hoodie. I want to buy 10 of them for all of my friends for the holidays. Wow. And so then the store called me and said, Matthew McConaughey just came, bought 10 of them. We need more hoodies. And so now people are buying the hats and the hoodies. And then I got a picture of Matthew McConaughey wearing the hoodie because at the time, you know, paparazzi are taking pictures of everybody. So I thought, okay, I don't really know exactly how to make a full collection, but I know that people are buying my hat and they're buying my hoodie. So I'm going to go in my car and drive all over the United States for 2 months, 3 months with my pictures of Matthew McConaughey and Jessica Alba and just walk into stores.
But tell me one thing. At the time, how did you make a living, actually? Because selling just 3 or 10 hats?
So I had been working at a TV studio.
Okay.
And I was doing marketing and advertising. So after the university, I was working for this TV studio that was doing, it was more animation. So if you know, like Inspector Gadget or the Chipmunks or, you know, kids television programming, but I was doing marketing. Good. So I was doing that on the side and then I would go on the weekends or I would go in the morning, I would go try to figure out how do I build the business. Yeah. So I was saving money.
Because you were not really crazy about TV production.
I just knew I wanted to start my own business. I wanted to control my own destiny.
Was it something in the family?
I think that
being an entrepreneur.
There are people in my family who are entrepreneurs, but actually most of my family is professionals, and I think a lot of them took the safe route. You know, maybe they wanted to be entrepreneurs or they had a creative idea, but they didn't take the risk to do it. And I knew when I was working at the TV studio, maybe I would see somebody in the elevator and it was, you know, Thursday afternoon.
Yeah.
And you say, oh, how's it going? And they say, just waiting for the weekend.
Oh my
And
God.
I would think to myself, I don't want to live my life just waiting for the weekend.
Of
just to
not.
Work 5 days and then live 2 days on the weekend. I wanted my life to be not work, just everything that I do 100% all the time.
Yeah.
Just living life.
Yeah.
And
where did you find this willingness to get out of this professional life?
So it was a little bit risky because at the time I had worked there for maybe a year or so. Mm. And when I moved to Europe, I also was working for them in Europe. So, cause they had an office here.
Okay. In which city?
It was in France, actually.
Oh,
so it was a French and US company.
So you speak French?
No, I mean, I can understand a few things on a menu, but that's it.
That's the best one.
But I'm learning. I'm trying to learn.
That's the best French.
So, but yeah, you know, I knew I needed to do something creative and really try to make something on my own. And I think the fact that I didn't have a technical background and I didn't really know how to make a collection work to my advantage.
Of course.
Because sometimes, you know, there's a saying in English, ignorance is bliss. Mm. Meaning, you know, if you don't know all of the challenges and you don't know all of the difficulties and how you're supposed to do something, you just go. Mm. And you don't think, well, maybe this, maybe that, this could go wrong, this could... No, just find a way to make it happen. Mm. And this was really my mentality. And so when I went on my US trip in my car for 2 months... You know, I had saved up some money. I had maybe $5,000-$6,000 that I had saved up. And I thought, okay, I can make it for 2 months going around. Mm. And I would just walk into a store And I would start looking around, you know, look through the rack. I would wait for somebody to come talk to me, say, can I help you? I said, oh, I'm from Los Angeles. I started a line. I have, you know, I'm just making hats and hoodies, but I'm selling in Fred Segal, and I have a picture of Jessica Alba. And little by little, I did this all over the United States. So I drove from Los Angeles to Arizona, through Texas, all the way to the East Coast, to Philadelphia, Chicago, New York.
Yeah.
I drove all the way up to Seattle, just walking into stores. Mm. And little by little, I got people to, you know, a few people bought the hat and the hoodie, and I had a t-shirt.
Yeah.
And so it was trial and error. So I came back to to LA.
But wait, were you choosing the retailers in terms of quality? I mean,
What I would do is I needed to figure out what are the retailers that I want to sell to.
Yeah.
So I went online and I looked at all of the competitors, and I said, okay, I want to be next to these brands. And I went on their website and I said, oh, okay, they're selling to this person, this person, this person. But I didn't go to the big stores first. I couldn't call up Neiman Marcus or Saks Fifth Avenue or the Bon Marché or something. Mm. I needed to start with small independent stores.
Why do you think so?
Because most people wanted to say no, regardless. Okay. And particularly a big store, they say, who is this guy coming in here? You have no distribution. Nobody knows who your brand is. So I thought, okay, let me try to start with some cool, smaller stores mm-hmm. who are willing to take a chance.
But Franck Segal was huge, no?
Which was?
Franck Segal.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like the Colette of the US, no?
Yes, yes.
So it was a big department. It was a small concept store, but it was very recognized. And that's thanks to your
friend. Yeah, it was
friend.
Definitely, I tried to make the story. I'm selling in Fred Segal.
Yeah.
Jessica Alba, Matthew McConaughey
yeah.
are wearing my clothes. I'm from Los Angeles. I have a cool background. I tried to craft the story so it was interesting for somebody. But, you know, it's hard because, you know, they want to know that your brand is something that that customers know. Mm. So it was challenging, but I did convince a lot of people to at least give me a test. Just even if you don't sell it, then you can call me and I'll take it back.
Yeah.
So there's no risk. So this is not a good long-term strategy to give everybody consignment, because at some point you need to be, you know, getting paid for your product. But I think to get in the door and to get a chance at a lot of these stores, I needed to take that risk.
Yeah.
So anyway, fast forward, I came back to Los Angeles, and now I need...
I've got a question.
Yeah.
When it comes to... When you figure out in what retailer you wanted to be, what was the brand you were looking at? Because in terms of positioning, to position a brand, you need to be you need to sit next to a brand you want to be compared to, right?
Yeah.
So what was the brand you were?
So at the time, I was looking for brands. It would be equivalent to something at the time like J Brand or Rag & Bone or even Isabel Marant or you know, some of these brands where maybe they have big department store distribution, but they also have really elevated boutiques. Mm-mm. And I was looking for the boutiques. Mm. And, you know, each city has a number of boutiques. So I would go to each city and say, okay, these are the five or six places that I can visit. Not everybody was going to say yes, but maybe I could get one person in each city to say yes.
Yeah.
So this was my strategy, is really...
Do you have any tips for when you enter a retail like that?
Yeah.
What was the attitude? What was the speech?
My sales strategy is always to be more understated, not to be very aggressive. I think sometimes if you go in and you're just selling, somebody says, whoa, too aggressive. Let me say no. So I think you need to try to build a connection with the person.
Yeah.
First build a connection with that person and let them think, okay, this is somebody that I want to talk to. Maybe you make them laugh. Maybe, you know, you tell them a joke. You just make them feel at ease that you're not just trying to like close a business deal. Yeah. Because in the end, that's too impersonal and becomes too much of a transaction. Mm. So I would try to tell people my story, let them know, let them feel my passion. I think that's really important, is that you have to believe your own story. You have to have the passion. Sometimes people say, oh, I want to start a clothing line. I need to get a sales representative to help me sell the line. Mm. No, you need to go sell the line.
Of course.
You need to have the passion for anything. Yeah. There's no shortcut.
Yeah.
And really, this is one of the main lessons, I think, for anybody trying to start not only fashion business, but any business. There's no fast track. You know, for 10 years, more than 10 years, every single day, almost every day of the week, I'm doing this business. Mm. But of course, on social media and on Instagram, everything looks easy. And you have, you know, bloggers are traveling here and going to all these places. And I think the mentality sometimes now is that you can be very successful just by, you know, snapping your fingers and saying, oh, I want to, you know, make this business, or I want to travel to all these places. But there's a lot of hard work that goes into building anything. Yeah. So
what was your why at the time? Why did you wanted to do that? I mean, you said it a little bit, but
yeah,
when you were a bit, how do you say it in English? I mean, when you were a bit low, I mean,
yeah.
I mean, when you've got, when, I mean, for example, when you are traveling in a city, you arrive in a city and you don't find any retailers.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, you are like, oh my God, I'm so low.
Yeah. Well, I actually can tell you many stories and I'll tell you some interesting stories about, you know, different challenges. But, you know, like I said, I always had this creative passion and I wanted to find a way to build this business. And it wasn't just the product, but the idea of building a business itself was creative. Okay, yeah. How do I identify stores? How do I go and get them to pay attention? How do I, you know, make something out of nothing?
Yeah.
And one thing I've realized about myself is I do have incredible determination and nothing, even if people told me no, that didn't stop me. I kept going.
Where did it come from? Sport?
Maybe from sport. But then I, you know, after a number of years, I tried to understand, okay, what really was driving me?
Yeah.
And I, you know, my family, both of my parents are very driven people. Mm. So my dad is a stockbroker. So he's every single morning for 40 years, he's gotten up 3:30 in the morning, goes to the office at 4:30 in the morning, because the stock market is based in New York City. We're from Los Angeles, so 3 hours behind. So always he gets there before the market opens, and just very hard determination of, you know, strong work ethic and achievement. And then, but they also have a creative background. His mom was a painter. Mm-hmm. His aunt was also a painter. And a lot of people in his family are artists. So I think this is sort of where I got both of those sides, is there's the business side, but then there's also the creative side. Mm. So
cool.
Yeah.
So tell us a bit more of the stories.
So then I, you know, after I went on this road trip, I came back to Los Angeles and I needed to figure out, how do I make clothes? Because now I started getting orders. So I couldn't just, you know, buy a hat. Now I need to produce clothes. So I would go downtown to the garment district, which is where you can buy fabric. They have people that sew, whatever, any product you want. So I would just walk into places and ask them, can you help me sew this hoodie? Can you help? And again, similar to how I walked in with the stores, a lot of people wanted to say, no, you have small volume production, we don't want to help you. Mm. But I found one person who was willing to help me. So I made a small amount of production in Los Angeles and I sent it out to the stores and people started buying them. And I started to get more celebrities were wearing the clothes, and just little by little, I was figuring things out. Like, how do I make product? And I would just walk into a sewing facility and I say, can I just stay here for 5 hours and watch you, how you sew? And then I went into a place where they make the fabric. I said, can I just watch how you make the fabric? So I was very curious about how the process works.
You were by yourself at the time?
By myself. Okay. So what I would do is I left the other job.
Okay.
Okay. So now I decided, okay, I'm going to focus now 100% on making this clothing line.
When was it after the beginning of the adventure?
So maybe this was, you know, 6 months after I started.
Okay.
Because I'd done the hats, then I was doing the road trip. I got orders and I said, okay, I really need to focus if this is going to be a real business. So I would wake up in the morning and on my computer, I would trade stocks for maybe 4 hours.
Okay.
So I had saved a little money. I was trying to, you know, make like little investments for 4 or 5 hours. Then in the afternoon, I would go downtown and then I would work on the clothing line.
Okay.
And little by little, I started to figure out, okay, this is how you make fabric. This is how you make a hoodie. This is how you make all the products. So it was very much trial and error. And, you know, over the next couple years, I was slowly building. I'm sort of jumping ahead because I want to get to a part in the story where there was a turning point. You can stop me if you want to.
Yeah, of course, of course.
But at some point I decided, okay, I need to make a collection that really is something enduring, a classic style that I can repeat season after season, that the brand is going to stand for something long term.
Yeah.
Because by now I had learned about how production worked.
So at the time, when you were talking to the retailers, what was the storytelling you were selling? What was when you talk about branding, about storytelling, you are, and when you are making a brand is selling something more than a product, right?
Yeah.
So what were you selling at the beginning, and what you decided to say at this point?
So this was a time where people were really paying attention to what celebrities were wearing.
Okay.
And so I started trying to connect with anybody I knew in Los Angeles that might know somebody who could wear the product. So through my network, I pass it to friends, and I started getting, you know, people in Los Angeles were starting to talk about the product and wear it because they saw, like I said, the Jessica Alba or Matthew McConaughey or Paris Hilton at the time was wearing it. And so, you know, first in the early days, I was trying to leverage the marketing side so people would pay attention to me. It wasn't as much based on the product. But then I knew, okay, long term, to make an enduring brand, you can't just be marketing. You have to have great product. So I decided, okay, I want to focus in the shirting category, button down shirts. And this was the real turning point for the business, because I said, I want to make a button down shirt, but I want to make it in a fabric that nobody is making it in. And I found almost like a cashmere scarf fabric. And I found these guys to help me make a fabric. They were in China.
Okay.
And at the time they also told me, well, you can't make shirts in this. Nobody's making shirts in this fabric because it feels so soft and so drapey. And I said, well, that's exactly why I want to make it, because it's going to be like nothing that's in the market and it's going to feel amazing. So it took me a number of tries to get a shirt fabric out of this really drapey, soft. It was a rayon blended fabric.
But what did you find the manufacturer?
So, okay. I'm trying. Sometimes it's hard because, you know, I have more than 10 years of experiences and adventures, and to try to tell them all in a short time is difficult. So before I went to these guys, I had started making shirts in Los Angeles. They were mostly in cotton, plaid shirts, button downs, right? But it was very hard to get the quality and the execution correctly in the US. And I was sitting in my office. I moved into an office that I was sharing with another girl. It was a very small office. Two of us were sitting face to face, but I needed at least somewhere other than my apartment to work. And I was getting really frustrated with the local production in Los Angeles. Somebody happened to call me on the phone, and I just picked up the phone and said, hello. And the guy said, hey, I'm calling you from a factory. We're a new factory. And we saw that your name was listed on a trade show from, you know, to sell product. And we want to know if you want help to make any products. And at that very moment, I was saying, you know what? Yes, I actually do need help. And I want to make this fabric that nobody's making. So they said, well, why don't you come to our factory, and you can show us what you want to make, and maybe we'll try to make it for you. And so I just took a chance, and I met with these guys, and together, and I'm still working with them. They, at the time, had 5 employees, and now they have 3,000 employees.
Whoa.
And at the time, I had just me, and now, you know, we have probably 200 employees. But together with these guys, we made this fabric that nobody was making in shirting. And so that really became the turning point, where the hand of the fabric was so soft. And so we went from a bunch of small stores, the little boutiques that I had visited, into much better stores like Intermix and Shopbop, and eventually places like Neiman Marcus and Saks Fifth Avenue. And then ultimately we expanded. And by we, I'm saying it was me at the time, internationally. And we went to places like Harvey Nichols and Harrods and Selfridges in the UK, ultimately, you know, to all of these global stores. So now we're selling in 40 countries, 1,500 stores. We have 15 sales agencies, 10 PR agencies. So, and this was really from the turning point of making this super soft fabric.
Yeah. So that's the turning point. Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit more about the different milestone of the growth of a company?
Yeah. So I would say, you know, the first early years were me trying to figure out how do you even make a product. So running around, trying to figure it out, like I just told you the stories.
Yeah.
The turning point was when I made the fabric that nobody was using in shirting. And so this set us into the new level where people were respecting what the Rails brand was for the product itself. Mm. And then we started getting some really bigger celebrities wearing our things, like Giselle was wearing a Rails shirt at the Super Bowl, Kate Moss, Beyonce. People now started showing up wearing this plaid shirt that I had made. And then that really got us global awareness. So it was because we had a great product, but then people started wearing it because it was a great product. Mm. So that was sort of the next evolution. And then, you know, the next milestone was evolving the collection, where we went from just the shirting brand and we started adding new categories, t-shirts, jackets, sweaters, dresses. And now we're a very full lifestyle collection.
Yeah.
Where you can buy all categories. And yeah.
Yeah. You think that was a must to expand to other categories or?
It's taken 10 years to evolve to that level.
Yeah.
So I think one of the challenges that people face and that a lot of maybe younger designers have is they want to be everything in the beginning.
Yeah, from day
one. And, oh, we want to be full collection. Mm. Sometimes it's better to really stand for something and be great at one thing. Mm. And we became really famous for the shirting. And that's still more than 50% of our brand is shirting. Mm. And, you know, if you ask customers, you know, I think a lot of them would tell you that Rails is the leading shirting brand in women's contemporary fashion. And I think it's because we spent a lot of years focusing on fabric development, making sure that the silhouette is right, and really focusing on becoming specialist in that category. But like anything, at some point you need to evolve, particularly in fashion. You can't just say one product forever and ever and ever. Mm-hmm. People want newness. They want to understand, okay, I want to make a full outfit, not just a top. What's the bottom? Is there a dress? Is there a jacket? Is there a sweater for layering pieces? Yeah. So, you know, after we had really established ourselves as a brand, then people were ready to buy the new categories. Mm. So slowly we introduced all the new categories, little by little, let people absorb that we're doing the new categories.
So what was the second one, the second category?
So the second category was we started doing t-shirts, like very soft t-shirts that were in the same fabric feel as the button-downs. And then we started to do more like lounge and sweaters, also like cashmere blended sweaters, things that felt super soft. Mm. And then we started feminizing the collection, doing more dresses. But a lot of times those shapes are in the same fabric we might use in the shirting category. So it feels connected. You can find a super soft shirt, but then the dress is also in that fabric. Mm-hmm. So it ties back to our heritage and our DNA.
Okay. Regarding the employees, who was your second employee? I mean, you're the second person working with you.
So for the first, maybe the first two years, I didn't have any money to hire a full-time employee. Mm. So I was working by myself. Then I started hiring some interns. And I don't know if that's a thing that people do here, but there were girls who were working at a local university, University of Southern California, which was near my office.
Yeah.
And so I had somebody who worked for one semester and then she graduated. And then she said, somebody I know is also looking for a job, so maybe she can replace me. So this is for, you know, a year and a half or 2 years. I just had some interns. Mm. And then the business was growing and I needed help. So one of the places I was buying fabric from, there was a girl who was working there doing accounting. I said, I need you to come work for me. There's too much paperwork. I need to do the shipping. I need to do... So she came and started working for me. She still works for me.
Whoa.
So 10 years later, my first employee still works there. Second employee, third employee, fourth employee. Everybody still works at Rails. Mm. And I think this is a huge part of why we've also been successful, is that the type of business that I'm running is very family style and very emotionally connected to our employees and to our customers. And our customers have an emotional connection to our brand because they feel the fabric and it feels like something more than just a product. There's something that gives you a cerebral and an emotional feel about our brand. Mm. And so I think everybody also who works at Rails also feels that. And we're driving towards a common goal together. And I think, you know, once you start establishing that you have a business and you're starting to grow your business, you really need to think about culture, your business culture. Like, what do you stand for as a company?
But isn't it something you need to think from the very, very beginning?
Well, I think sometimes, you know, I do have a lot of people that ask me, you know, give me advice on how to start a business. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people start thinking about all of the things on the outside of the business and the second level things. But to me, the most important thing is, what is your product? What do you have an amazing product that people need to buy? Because you have to have an amazing product that is going to resonate with a customer. Then the second thing is, okay, how are you going to be efficient about making your product and delivering your product? You have to be able to make money so you can stay in business. So sometimes people have a great idea, but then they're not being able to manage their finances to grow the business. So, you know, I told you I started with $5,000. I never borrowed money. We never took, you know, investment. I just keep reinvesting the money slowly, slowly, slowly. And now we've done, you know, over the course of 10 years, $350 million in sales on a $5,000 investment. So
it's a good return.
Yeah. And I think sometimes people also feel like, well, I don't have the money to start a business, or I need to get an investor. And it depends on what business you want to do. But sometimes you don't need to, it doesn't need to be about the finance. It needs to be first about the product and then start small. You know, don't go out and buy 2,000 units of your first product because maybe the market's not going to like it. Maybe you're going to put it out there and they're going to say, oh, actually it would be better if you change this thing. And and then you agree, yeah, I need to change that. And now you have 2,000 units that you just bought. So start slowly. Make sure that the product you're making people really want to buy. Then expand little by little. And make sure that you stand for something and that customers can identify you with some vision or some concept or something that's uniquely yours.
What do you stand for?
I think first and foremost, we stand for the super luxe hand feel that customers, when they feel it, whether they know about our marketing, whether they've heard about our brand, they feel the product and they say, wow, this is something special. And that's the hook. That's what gets people in. And then once they're into our brand, they return season after season and they become collectors because it's something that you can wear casually during the day. You can dress it up and wear it out at night and you can live in our product. And I think that's, you know, really what sets us apart from a lot of other people in our space. We still spend a lot of time doing fabric development. Every season we're innovating new fabrics. You know, and it's become somewhat technical. Like over time we've learned how fabric works. How is it constructed? What size yarn? What composition? If you make the yarn a certain size and you do a certain, you know, organization of the yarns, it's going to lead you to this type of hand feel. So there's a lot of testing. But we like to come to the market saying, this is our new fabric that we made in our pattern. You're not going to go and find it in another brand. And that's taken time to develop. But we try to maintain that as a really important part of our brand DNA.
Okay. Do you have any copycats?
Certainly. I mean, in fashion, if you're doing something well, people want to copy you and chase you. So,
and how do you protect yourself? Because when you've got a product, I mean...
Well, there's, you know... In fashion, you need to expect that people are going to try to imitate your style. So there's two ways to deal with that. You know, for if you go to Zara or you go to H&M or you go to fast fashion, they're copying a lot of what the big brands are doing. And they're doing it very well. You go to Zara, people love Zara because it's great fashion, great price, and they're fast to market. So I think the expectation is that the market will copy really great trends. You should try to copyright or trademark things that you can, but sometimes things are not, you can't copyright. So if you have a stripe pattern in a button down shirt, maybe you can't copyright that. You know, we made certain we did certain yarn constructions, but we didn't necessarily invent them, but we used them in a way which was unique. So certain things we have trademarks on, if we do unique prints, if we do, you know, certain constructions, but there's also some part of fashion business that you're gonna be imitated, and you should use it as a sign that you're doing something very well and continue to innovate. Mm. And this is why we spend a lot of time on new development and new concepts, is so that we're constantly ahead of our competitors.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I want to come back on the culture. So you were saying that your culture is very family culture. Mm-hmm. How does it translate to every department of the company?
So, you know, as I mentioned, a lot of people have worked at Rails for a long time.
Yeah.
So they know the history. They know where we came from. They understand my passion for building the business. Mm. And I think they feel that. And they feel like they're a key part of our success. So I think one is empowering people in the business to feel like they're not just working for you, or they're not part of a machine, that everything they're doing, even if they're working in the office, if they're working in design, if in sales, if they're working in the warehouse, people just putting tags on the garments, they're equally as important as somebody who's running the company, because everybody is part of the system. Hmm. And so I think letting people know that, you know, they're an important part of what's happening makes them feel passionate about what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And I think also people want to work for a company that they know is being successful. Mm. And I think if you go out into the market and you talk to stores and you talk to customers, people genuinely love Rails. Mm. And I think it gives, you know, people who work at our company a great satisfaction that all the hard work that they're putting in and people in the outside world are recognizing what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. When you come to management, you didn't learn to be a good manager. That was something very natural in you, or did you get trained? Or did you train yourself? What book did you read? Or did you ask anybody to help you on this point?
I did not read a ton of management books.
Yeah.
Partly because I wanted to use my intuition, mm-hmm. and I think for me that style worked, because everything I was doing along the way, in general, was working. Mm. You know, there were many challenges, which I'll tell you about some of the specific episodes shortly, but most of what I was doing felt right for me personally. And I didn't want to try to follow someone else's strategy here and then somebody else's strategy here, because I wanted to do what felt right for me. But in the early days, you know, one of the challenges for me is that I'm very much a doer. I like to actually get my hands dirty and do the work. Mm. But as you build a team, sometimes you can't always do the work, because you need to be able to delegate the responsibility and give power to other people to do the work and then maybe become a little bit more of a manager. For me, it has been a transition, because I love being involved in all elements of our business, but I recognize that as our business has grown from, you know, a very small operation to this, you know, much bigger operation, that my time is not best used by always being in the small details. Sometimes stepping back, working on macro strategy, giving, you know, freedom to people in the design team, in the sales team, in marketing and e-commerce team to drive their own business within our business, but collaborate. And I think that's really how a successful business grows. And, you know, I think if you look at really big companies, particularly like tech companies like Google or Amazon or, Apple. You know, really successful, Apple or, you know, even fashion companies, the ones that share a common goal, that have clearly defined goals as a company and as individuals, are the ones that are being successful. Sometimes if everybody is running around and they each have their own identity in each department, you're going in too many directions. And I think what we've really tried to do is focus on a common goal. Mm. And that's why we're all going together on this journey.
What is it?
So I think, you know, to build a really big global fashion brand that's focused first on product and building a connection with our customer, not always focused on the bottom line. Yeah. I think one of the challenges for a lot of businesses, when they grow from a small business to a bigger business, they start making decisions based on financial metrics.
Yeah.
We need to hit a certain profitability, and we need to grow our revenue. So that means we need to sell to more stores, but that maybe means then you start selling to
best stores.
Yeah. Mm. Not the best stores. Mm. But you need to grow your revenue. And then all of a sudden your brand becomes not as cool because you're in maybe second level stores. So it's always a challenge to make sure that you're growing your business, but you're protecting your brand. because nothing is as important as your brand, as your product, as what the customer feels when they interact with your brand. And
but this is something that's a very important point, I think. Yeah. Because in our days, I mean nowadays, you need to grow, to grow, to grow. If you don't grow, you get it. You understand what I mean? But I mean, at some point, if you want to protect your brand, if you want to protect your DNA and your values, you cannot do that, no?
Yeah, I think it's a fine line between, you know, having a long term view of what your business can be. I think sometimes the opportunity is there short term to make more money, but it's at the potential risk of devaluing your brand, and then who knows what may be going out of business. So once you become successful, you'll have a lot of people asking you, oh, we want to carry your line. You know, maybe we can give you a big order, but we need a little bit lower price. And sometimes you have to say no. And the best strategy is to say no to the places that don't make sense for your brand. Because 10 years from now, 20 years from now, we still want to be around. I mean, you look at a brand like Levi's. You know, this is a heritage brand that's been around for 100 years. You know, of course, in fashion, there's always peaks and valleys. But I think if you maintain your DNA and you maintain what's the core values of your business, you'll sustain and you'll be able to, you know, have successes. And even if the market goes down or the economy isn't as great, that people will still care about your brand.
Yeah. Who is your role model?
You know, I don't know if I have any role models in the fashion space. I think, you know, I look at people who have really worked hard, even my parents, how much time and energy they've put into trying to be successful and to build not only, you know, a professional life, but also build a strong family life. And I think that's important. And like I mentioned about creating culture, you know, people who are doing that, trying to find the balance, I think are people that I look after.
Do you succeed in doing this?
Do you
succeed in having a life balanced?
No.
A balanced life? No.
No. And that's honestly, I think this is one of the things I'm really trying to work on now is, you know, I don't view work in the sense that it's work. To me, this is life. Every day I wake up, I'm excited to go to work. I'm excited to create something. I'm excited to, you know, work with the team that works in our office and you know, it feels empowering. I think the one area where I probably not spent as much time is in my personal life. And I've had to sacrifice some personal relationships, you know, really cultivating that side of my life because so many things are happening in this Rails world. And I think that's a challenge for a lot of entrepreneurs is, you know, you get so focused on building your business and on your concept and on your idea that, you know, sometimes maybe the things outside of that work life start to suffer. So, you know, trying to find the right balance, I think, is really important and making sure you can step out and be creative and recharge your batteries and not forget about all the other things that are important in life, which is family and enjoyment and culture and all of those things too.
What have been the biggest mistake or the worst moment of your life of Rails?
Well, so, you know, there've been a lot of incidents. So one of the things that happened very early on, I got my first big order from a store called Anthropologie, which is a big store in the US. And it was for maybe 2,000 units of the shirt that I had done. And it was worth $80,000 order. And I was, you know, it took me 2.5 or 3 months to produce the order. I was making it in Los Angeles. I had no employees. I had one intern. I was doing everything myself. So I was going every day to the factory to make sure, okay, you're sewing, everything's looking good. It came out. I packed all the boxes by myself, 2,000 units in my office. I taped them all. I put the stickers on. An 18-wheel truck comes to pick up the boxes. And I helped the guy load them all onto the truck. It was probably 100 boxes of product. And I was so excited. I was celebrating. I went out with my family and my friends and I had drinks. And I said, this is an $80,000 order. Like I'm in now. The next morning I woke up and I got a call from, and it was the trucking company. And they said, sorry to inform you, but our truck was robbed yesterday in the afternoon after we picked up your shirts. We don't know where any product is, but we'll let you know. And I was like shocked. The truck was robbed. And I remember when I loaded my shirts onto the truck, I remember this was a time when J Brand, the denim brand, was very popular.
Yeah.
And there was all of these boxes of J Brand on the truck. And I think it was probably somebody trying to steal all of the J Brand jeans, and my shirts just got stolen at the same time. So I said, well, when are you guys going to pay me? And they said, well, we don't know. It has to go through insurance. So ultimately, it took almost 8 months to get paid by the insurance company. I called the store and I said, can I please just remake the shirts and try to ship them to you? They said, sorry, it's going to be too late. We needed them now, so we can't take them. So this is something that could have put a lot of people out of business. Mm. But I figured, look, I had to tighten up because at this point I didn't have the revenue and it took me 8 months to get paid by the trucking company. So, you know, I thought I'm not going to let this stop me. I think a lot of people would have said, this is too crazy. I need to stop.
Yeah.
But somehow I figured, let me just try again. Later I got another order from that store for a different product and I kept going, but things like that happen. Mm. And what I learned was you really have to be thick-skinned, you have to be a problem solver. You can't let things that go wrong put you off course.
Yeah.
And that's not always easy to do, but I think that's one of the biggest challenges, but also one of the traits that I learned that has allowed me to move forward is constantly be problem solving. Don't get emotional about things that don't go the way you expect them. People want to say no. People might steal your stuff when you don't expect it. Things happen and you just have to be prepared and really try to continue to evolve and problem solve. And that's for any entrepreneur, they need to have that skill. Yeah.
If you had a chance to, I mean, if you started the Rails today, how would you do it?
So, yeah, I think it's always challenging to start a business from nothing. And I think the way that I started Rails worked for me, and not having the technical background to me was a benefit. I think a lot of people would imagine, okay, you need to go to fashion school, you need to learn about how to make product and how the business works, then you need to go work for a company and spend some time working for a company so you learn how that works. But I think what happens is sometimes that ends up scaring people into thinking it's too big to start your own business and it's too complicated. Somebody's already making that product or, you know, so it creates a lot of excuses. Why not? Hmm. And I think if you have a good idea, sometimes you just need to take the risk and go for it. Hmm. Maybe it's going to work out. Maybe it's not going to work out, but you'll always regret if you didn't take the chance and try to make it happen. Hmm. And I think for me, that was the number one thing is the passion and the drive to succeed and being able to take the risk.
Yeah. And when you've got a student calling you and asking you, what do you advise me to do? I want to start a business in fashion. Should I go to school or should I start it right now?
Yeah.
What do you advise?
I think it depends on what area they want to be in.
Yeah.
So if somebody really wants to be a designer and they're not interested in starting a business so much as they want to be a designer, then I would say, go to school, learn about the trade or the craft of being a designer. I think if you want to start a business, you don't necessarily need to go to school. It helps to understand how the business works, whether you have experience in a retail store or whether you do have experience working for a brand. Anything you understand about the business will help you. But I don't think it's a prerequisite. I don't think you need to have the understanding of everything when you go into it. Mm. Some of it is you have to be intuitive. You have to have something that resonates with a customer. You know, you have to have a product that's marketable. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, sometimes when we interview designers, they'll come with a portfolio that's, you know, very design heavy and maybe the sleeves have a lot of ruffles and it's overly designed. And I think you have to decide, well, what part of the market do you want to be in? Mm-hmm. You know, if you want to be merchandising and you want to really be able to hit a lot of different people, contemporary market, but still accessible to a lot of people, it has to be something that's easy to wear, effortless, that resonates. If you want to do couture, that's a whole different track. And, you know, there's a much smaller market of people who are buying and wearing couture clothing. Mm. So I think for me, I said, look, I'm not coming from a super design background. I want to make product that people want to wear every day, that's versatile, that's accessible, that feels amazing, that has a good price point. And for me, it was more about being practical as opposed to being, you know, super avant-garde and designer driven.
Yeah. What is your creative process?
Well, I'm traveling all the time. Yeah. So, you know, before this, I was in Germany, I was in Amsterdam, now I'm in Paris, I'm going to London next week and then to Rome. I'm often going to Asia or to just different places all over the world and trying to be inspired by the things I see. And it may be clothing, it may be fabrics, it may be, you know, going to an antique market and seeing, you know, different pieces of furniture or architecture. I think there's different elements of sort of the visual experience that resonate with me and trying to find ways to put that into the Rails design. But I love culture, whether it's, again, you know, music or art or architecture. I think having some emotional feeling about something is critical.
Yeah. What is your favorite places in Paris?
I wish I had more time here. You know, oftentimes when I'm coming here, there's a lot of meetings and, you know, visiting the stores and doing PR trips, but I love just walking and exploring the streets, and whether you're, you know, walking along the river or going this weekend, I'm going to go to the antique market and do flea market shopping.
Yeah. Because Saint-Ouen or something like that. Yeah,
exactly. Because I think, you know, that's a different side of a city that maybe a typical tourist doesn't always get. And, you know, I'd like to collect items from my travels and bring them back to the US with me. I just bought a house, which is outside of Los Angeles, about an hour outside of Los Angeles. And it has a very European sensibility to it. And I'm trying to collect some items from my travels that I can have with me in the house as sort of, you know, memories of places that I've been, but also reminders of the path that I've taken to get to that point. Mm-hmm. So
when it comes to your employees, how do you choose them? What do you look in somebody? What do you want to find?
Yeah, I think the number one thing is, first, I always ask if they know about our brand, because I want to make sure that somebody who's coming to work for Rails is working for Rails because they're excited about working for us, that they're not just looking for a job. Because to me, having people that work for a long time and feel passionate is the way you build a good business. And sometimes if you have somebody that's just looking for a job, they're going to be there for maybe 6 months, maybe 1 year, maybe 2 years, and then they leave. So I think finding somebody that really is excited for working at our brand. Mm-hmm. And then I think people that have an opinion, that are driven, that have personal pride. To me, personal pride is something you cannot teach. And, you know, as the business grows, I can't be next to every employee all the time.
Does it mean personal pride?
Personal pride means people wanting to achieve for themselves, not just because the business is asking them to create a collection or to come up with a marketing campaign or to make a sale or to do accounting. They need to want to be successful because it gives them personal satisfaction to do a good job. And that's when everybody has personal pride and personal drive for success, then they don't need to be micromanaged. Because, you know, on their own, they're acting like an entrepreneur. Yeah. And I think that's really important for building a strong team, is people need to be entrepreneurs in their own area of the business.
That's a good point. But when you are looking for people who want to become entrepreneurs, who are entrepreneurs, at some point they're going to leave to start their own business, no?
Maybe, but maybe not. I think some people have an entrepreneurial drive, but they might not want to be their own entrepreneur and start their own business. But I think people still, even within a company infrastructure, want to feel empowered. They want to feel like they have a say in what's happening, that they have influence over the company. And I think for a lot of people, that may be enough. Then you have some people that really want to start their own business. And yes, we've had people that worked at Rails. There was somebody who was working for our company in production. He was doing garment production. And he came to me and said, I want to start my own business. And, you know, he ended up going off and starting his own accessories business. And he's been very successful. And that's great, because I think if you have that drive and something is telling you need to go and start a business, you should do that. And if we were able to help provide some background on that process and maybe some skills that he's ultimately using today, then hopefully we were able to be part of that process in some way. So I would never stop anybody that really has the drive to do that.
Yeah. When it comes to a communication strategy, at what point you ask a PR agency to take care of you?
So we hired a PR agency pretty early on in Los Angeles. Mm. This is when we started getting the celebrity press. I knew, okay, this is working, this concept of getting pictures of celebrities wearing your product because people start paying attention. So the first investment that I made was to hire a local PR agency in Los Angeles. It didn't cost me that much money. I said, I don't have a budget. All I can do is pay you a small amount of money every month, but I can try to give you product that you can give to people. Mm. So we worked on this strategy, and every season I would give them, you know, here's 50 pieces, some shirts and some jackets or whatever, and they would give it to the celebrities that they knew, and we would start getting some pictures. So to me, like, that was really important to build the brand. Again, this, I never paid anybody to wear anything. They were wearing it because they genuinely liked the product. And that's something that you can't fabricate. So you have to have a great product. Otherwise, people are just going to say, pay me. And then it's not authentic. So to me, growing an authentic brand on the communication strategy was really important. So once I recognized that the PR strategy was working, we ultimately, as we expanded into international markets, I tried to replicate the success that we had in the US in international markets. So we started getting attention from the UK, probably because, you know, they speak English, they were following what we were doing. So we found a sales agency. I went over to London. I went with them to the stores. We started selling to some boutiques. Eventually got into Harrods and Harvey Nichols. But I also put a PR agency, like a small one-person PR agency, so it didn't cost a lot. Same strategy as in the US. I can pay you a small amount per month, but I can give you clothes to give out to local celebrities. Maybe I can tell the story about Rails. And it started working there too. And people started liking the product and we started getting people wearing the clothes. So I said, I'm going to use this strategy in every market that we expand. So now, you know, we have a sales agency in France and we have a PR agency in France. And we did the same thing in Spain and in Germany and in Scandinavia. So in Norway and in Denmark, in Sweden, in Canada, in Australia. And I spend a lot of my time now going to visit all of those markets, visiting the stores, visiting with, you know, editors and having PR meetings, trying to build the brand from an organic level.
Do you see any difference between the markets, in between the markets?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly local nuances of each market. And, you know, there are different publications, there's different influencers, but our product is working in all the markets. And I think that's really what is allowing us to grow, is that, you know, the soft fabric that we have, whether you're in the US or you're in France or you're in Scandinavia or Australia, it feels amazing and the customer recognizes that. Mm-hmm. I think there's, you know, different categories that work in different countries. Being a California brand, you know, for the first part of our business, it's very lightweight t-shirts and, you know, California, it doesn't get cold ever. So you don't even have an opportunity to wear a jacket. But as we've expanded into all these other countries, we've started bringing in more traditional outerwear, you know, knitwear and sweaters and things that the global market wants. Mm. And this was part of our evolution, is really to become a global brand, you need to service the global customer.
Yeah.
And so that's part of the evolution of the collection, is being able to have customers across the globe being able to wear our product.
Yeah. What are the next big challenges or the next big milestones for you?
So, you know, to this point, we've been primarily a wholesale business. We've been selling to specialty stores, department stores, but we're trying to migrate more direct to consumer and control the interaction between our brand and our customer. Mm. So right now we're relying on whether it's Saks Fifth Avenue or Nordstrom or a boutique shop to display our brand, to communicate the message about our product to the ultimate customer. There's so many things happening with our brand, and we're traveling for our photo shoots, and we want to be able to communicate directly with our customer now. So on our e-com platform, really making that an experience where people from all over the globe can come and buy our product. And actually 50% of the traffic on our website is from international markets. So You know, people are coming from France. They're coming from the rest of Europe, all over.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to start to open our own stores. So we just did a pop-up shop in Los Angeles. We're doing another pop-up right now in London. And we're hoping to open a permanent store in Los Angeles end of this year.
Wow.
And then New York in the beginning of next year.
Mm-hmm.
And then hopefully after that in different cities and also in Europe. So, and it's not meant to replace the wholesale business, but to be complementary. Because,
and balance it, no?
Yeah, and I think customers want to be able to shop wherever they want to shop. Some customers want to go to a boutique and they want that experience. Mm. Some customers want to go directly to the brand online. Some would want to go into a branded store and see everything in person. So I think, you know, we're trying to make sure that we're in every place where a customer wants to buy the product, that they can have that type of experience.
Mm-hmm. But if you had a chance, I asked you already this question, but you know, nowadays we are talking about DNVB, Digital Native Vertical Brands only. Yeah. A lot of people are saying, okay, this is the only way to go on market right now.
Yeah.
Forget the wholesale, etc. What would you recommend?
I would say if people are starting a brand, I would probably focus more on direct-to-consumer because that is more the future of where retailing is going and how you can control the interaction between your brand and the customer. And you can communicate so many messages to the customer and explain to them who you are, where you came from, what your brand is about. And of course, the margin that you're getting on every product sold is much higher than if you're selling it in the wholesale channel. But I still think that for us, the wholesale channel is an important part of our history and an important part of where our customers know us. So we don't want to abandon that altogether because those stores have been a really important part of helping us build our brand. And it's challenging for small stores now to compete with online retailing and fast fashion. And, you know, we want to be part of helping a lot of those stores continue to grow and stay in business and make sure that there's a local feel to a lot of the communities where they're selling.
There's another topic I want to talk about. This is sustainability. This is quite hot right now in Europe and I think in the world. What's your sustainability strategy? Do you work on this? What's your point of view on this?
Yeah, I think as a company, of course, we're conscious of our impact on the environment. And I think fashion in particular has a big impact on the environment. So, you know, we work very closely with our factories, one, to make sure that they're gold wrap certified, means like they're the top certification of all factories, not only for environment, but for
social impact as well.
Yeah. Social impact. What are the working environments of the employees? Do they have good work hours? Are they treated well? So we always are visiting the factories to make sure like that's a key component of our supply chain. I think from the sustainability side, you know, we have a lot of different products. The honest truth is not all of them are fully sustainable. I think we're trying to figure out how do we migrate more to sustainability and make sure that we're not doing, you know, like denim pollution and understanding the impact of every type of category. Mm-hmm. I think also things that we do in-house as a brand is we're in California, in Los Angeles, where people are very conscious of health, environment, their impact on society. So, you know, whether it's recycling programs that we're doing, you know, different philanthropic things we do, not specifically related to sustainability only, but we do a lot of charitable things. So we selected, for example, last season to partner with a group that works on breast cancer awareness. And we made a product that all of the profits went to breast cancer awareness and we donated maybe $50,000 to that cause. So I think identifying causes that are important to us as a brand and, you know, trying to give back in some way is important.
Mm-mm-mm.
Yeah.
What would you do differently?
With the business?
Yeah.
Well, I think there were a lot of mistakes that I made early on. But I think the mistakes that I made ultimately made me a better business person and made our business stronger. You know, whether we tried to proceed too quickly into some categories or, you know, we tried to do too many different things early on or we weren't using the right factory for something. I think all of those things allowed me to understand, okay, this was the wrong way to do it. This is how we need to do it in the future. And I don't think any business can just make correct decisions and be successful. You have to make mistakes to be successful. And you also can't be afraid to make the mistakes. And that's part of the risk is that you have to go out there and not take blind risk, take calculated risk, but you know, maybe something you're going to do is not going to work, but use it as a learning experience and continue to get stronger. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, one of the things that I really have tried to focus on, which I wasn't early on, was this idea of empowering our staff and our employees. Yeah. And our, I think people are so important to be building a successful business, and having people work at your brand for a long time is to me one of the most important parts. And I think I'm focusing now more than I have on the past on trying to cultivate that type of environment.
Yeah. When it comes to setting your objectives, what is the process?
So I personally always like to step back and reset the business. Like look at macro level. Where are we going? What's happening from each of the categories? Whether it's design or production or marketing or sales, what's working in each of those channels, and what are our challenges in each of those channels? And then how do we address the things that are going well and accentuate those, and then the things that are going wrong or that we need to improve, what is the strategy for improving those, and what is the timeline? Sometimes you'll see, wow, there's 15 things we need to do. But you can't do all of them at one time. So you have to prioritize. You have to say, okay, for us, this year is really about branding. This is one of our goals for 2019 and 2020 is branding and display.
Yeah.
We also want to do 5 other things, but we need to make a priority list. Mm. And so for me, I always look macro strategy, then look at the departments. What are our goals? Try to put a timeline to those goals and then share those with the team, so that we can collectively work on the goals together.
Mm-mm. And what's your ultimate goal?
You know, I want to continue to build the brand and really focus on the creative side of the business. Yeah. I think even as we're growing, and I mentioned not getting distracted by the financials of the business, but make sure that we're always focusing on great product. Yeah. And, you know, we've been really focused in the women's business. Now I'm excited. We just launched our men's business. So this is great for me because, you know, for 10 years it's been mostly women. So finally I'm going to have a collection to wear, but to grow the men's business and really to become a global brand. Ultimately, we want to expand beyond just fashion. I think first we would probably expand into home, like blankets and sheets and pillows, and really going back to that soft hand feel that we've created in the apparel line. And then with all the creativity that's happening, who knows what opportunities there are for us in other cultural angles, whether it's, you know, entertainment content that we create that's really with our brand DNA, whether we're collaborating with directors or photographers or artists on, you know, just different creative ventures. I think there's a place for us to communicate what our creativity is to the world, not just in the fashion space.
What is the most inspiring thing right now for you?
Are you talking about for the apparel line or just for me personally?
For you personally.
Well, I think, like I mentioned, all of the travel that I get to do, I feel so lucky that I get to see so many places in the world, and, you know, trying to spend a moment to absorb the cultures and the different cultures and the nuances of each place, because what you realize now is the world is, everything is so close. You can go on Instagram and see everything all over the world. You can very easily go to any airport now and fly all over in one day, and you can be somewhere. But really trying to understand, like, taking your head away from the phone and not thinking about every location as an Instagram location, really trying to connect with a person who lives there. What drives them? What's the culture about in each place? And to me, I think, like, that's what gives me an emotional sensibility more so than, you know, business success or financial success. It's really like connecting with people and absorbing different cultures around the globe.
All right. If you had a chance to say something to yourself when you were 20 years old, what would you say?
Well, I would not tell myself all of the things that would happen, because I think the idea of the unknown at that time was what drove me. I think there was an element of the insecurity of not knowing what the future was going to be that to me was what was my motor. And what, when I went to a store and they told me no, or they said yes, to whatever it was, to keep going. And I think that lack of knowledge was a driving factor for me. But I would definitely tell myself to, you know, be a problem solver, keep your calm in all scenarios when, you know, maybe you have a concept or you get negative feedback from somebody, to not be discouraged, to be thick-skinned and resilient, and to keep pushing forward.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we are coming to the end of the interview. I've got one last question for you. Who would you like to listen to in this podcast?
Well, I would like young entrepreneurs, and they don't have to be young entrepreneurs. They could be anybody that wants to start a business, or somebody that has an idea about something and is maybe afraid to take a risk, or is afraid to take a chance, or feels like it's overwhelming, that it is possible, that anything can be done. You know, you have to have some talent, but you also just have to have the drive. And if you never take that first step to make that potential dream a reality, you're always going to regret it. So take that first step, believe in yourself, believe that you can overcome things. Even if it doesn't work out in the beginning, don't give up. You know, find a way to maybe change your strategy, pivot your business, and keep moving forward. And there's nothing more rewarding than creating a product or a brand or an experience that gives somebody else enjoyment, and that you see a customer really saying, like, wow, I love this thing. I love what you've given me or created for me. It's an incredible feeling. And you know, hopefully somebody that's listening to this podcast will do that and also experience that.
Great. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to Entreprendre dans la Mode. If you like the episode, please send a message to my guest to thank them for their generosity. If you want to support Entreprendre dans la Mode, subscribe on whatever podcast platform you follow. Just click on the subscribe button, rate it 5 stars, and leave us a comment on Apple Podcasts. To not miss any news, follow me on Instagram or Twitter. Thank you for listening to Entreprendre dans la Mode, and see you next week for a new episode.